Bradley. We welcome you here, and I hope that along with myself, you're looking forward to hearing this really another incredible story about what goes on here in Utah and concerning the Mormons and all of the crazy, wonderful, interesting things that happen.
Gold. Even the word seems to ring with excitement. Well, the lure of this precious metal has changed the course of men and of nations. And Elder John Jacquet once wrote in the Millennial Star, "What will men not do for gold? They'll toil for it, they'll lie for it, swear for it, steal for it, murder for it, live for it, and die for it. They will do more and suffer more 10 times over for gold than they'll do or suffer for eternal life and happiness." Well, sadly, the history has proven that man is willing to vote for anyone or anything. He'll cross oceans, he'll swelter in the deserts and sell themselves body and soul, all in the pursuit of this precious metal. Well, gold is mentioned as early as the second chapter of Genesis in the Bible, and yet, since that time, it's seldom been used in the manner that God has intended. The children of Israel once worshipped a cow made of gold. Today, the shape of that golden image has changed, but is still a subject of worship. Well, the story of the dream mine, how it started, and the purpose of it is completely different than almost any other mine. You can't tell the story of the dream mine without telling the story of Bishop Coyle. He was born back in 1864, and he became a bishop of the Leland Ward for 12 years, more than 12 years, and he had many spiritual gifts during that time, and he went on to receive the church's highest blessings, the second anointings. The story of this mine, located in the hills above Salem, Utah, really begins shortly after his marriage to Emily Holt in 1884. And this young couple purchased a small farm in the Salem area to raise a few cattle. Well, the loss of one of their heifers was a rather serious economic setback for the family. And so after several days of searching for the animal, John asked the Lord in prayer to help him find it. And the answer came in a very unusual dream showing that his cow was down by a railroad track. He had been hit by a train and the horn was bent over and kind of poking in his eye. Well, he woke up and told his wife that he knew where the cow was, and he got on his horse and he went down by the railroad trestle, and there he found the cow just like he saw in the dream. Well, on the way home, he thought this was a very unusual experience, and it was a beautiful experience for him and one that he treasured. And he made a promise to the Lord as he was going home that the Lord would bless him with that gift. He would serve him all the days of his life. Well, 3 years passed, and then he received a call to go on a mission for the church. And one of his first experiences in the southern states was a warning dream about a threatening mob. Once again, the gift of dreams came to his rescue, and by following instructions, he avoided a serious conflict with the mob. Another occasion, he dreamed that a mob would form at a missionary conference, but this time, the mission president, J. Golden Kimball, would be the one who would be in danger. Elder Coyle warned President Kimball of the dream, so he did not attend the conference. As shown in Coyle's dream, a mob interrupted the meeting, and the leader demanded to know where that long, lanky, red-headed elder was. Upon learning he was not there, the mob then departed without any trouble. When J. Golden Kimball heard of this incident, he said to Elder Coyle, "If you ever have any more of those dreams, please let me know about them." And it was because of this that J. Golden Kimball and Bishop Coyle became lifelong friends. Well, although his mission for the church came to an end, Coyle's spiritual gifts did not. He resumed his business as a farmer, and one night on August of 1894, he had a most unusual experience. A heavenly messenger appeared to him, instructing that he had been chosen to perform a special work for the Lord. He was reminded of the ancient Nephite civilization that once was here and flourished on this continent, how they rose in great power and wealth, eventually became wicked, corrupt, and were finally destroyed. He was told that the present generation was about to take a similar course, except there would be a few who would be spared. The messenger took John to a mountain just east of Salem and showed him a rich Nephite gold mine. He was instructed he was to drill tunnels in that mountain in order to reach the gold that once was there by the Nephites. and he would be directed by dreams to do this work, which would require many years and much money. He was told not to enter the mountain through the old existing Nephite tunnel located on the south side of the mountain, but rather to blast new tunnels. One was to run nearly a mile horizontal into the mountain, and then it was to drill down through a 3-foot capstone into 9 large rooms once mined by the Nephites. The ore at this place would be so rich that he said that there seemed to be more gold than rock. John was very reluctant to accept his calling and explained to the messenger that he was only a farmer and knew nothing about mining. Furthermore, he didn't have any money nor any influence to undertake such a project. However, he was reminded of his promise to the Lord, and if he would accept the task, he was told that the necessary men and money would always be available. As proof that this heavenly messenger was speaking the truth, John was told that his neighbor had been working on a water well, and that tomorrow at 12 o'clock noon, the well would come in. And because of that, he would know then that that was his mission to do. Well, he told his wife about it, and so she kind of watched. And during the day, she heard a lot of shouting and yelling, and she went to the door and looked out, and there was water shooting out of the water well. And she turned around and looked at the clock, and it was exactly 12 o'clock noon. Well, the work began September 3rd of 1894, drilling for that in those tunnels. Many years following, they followed a cream-colored leader, often discovering peculiar markings or formations described by John before they were actually found. The bishop was shown that 3 men would be killed on that mountain. Eventually, there were 3 that were killed by accidents. Stockholders were told that 100 shares of stock would be enough for any man's family. Also, the day would come when men would go to court for 1 share. Through the years, there have been about 50,000 people directly or indirectly involved in that mine. For many years, the church took no interest in Bishop Coyle's dream mine. Some members had stock, others had not, and they were not concerned about it. But in the early 1900s, a strange thing happened. The 3-year Senate investigation during the Smoot hearings had just finished, and the church was especially sensitive about the issue of plural marriage. Joseph S. Smith went to Mexico in 1911, telling the saints that they should give up plural marriage, and if they would, he promised them the next temple would be built in Mexico. However, when Bishop Coyle heard the announcement, he said President Smith wouldn't make a promise like that if he had seen what I saw in a dream. He continued with the prophecy that Mexican soldiers would drive the saints out of Mexico, allowing them only to take a little luggage. Word spread to Bishop Coyle's prophecy that the next temple would not be built in Mexico. But the church president had announced that it would. Both claimed divine instruction. Church members and stockholders became apprehensive of which prophecy would be fulfilled. Then in 1912, the revolutionary forces of Francisco Madero and Pancho Villa began a revolution by attacks on the border towns. When they learned of the Mormons' neutrality, they drove them out of Mexico, allowing only 1 piece of baggie each, according to Bishop Coyle's dream. But such a catastrophe was regrettable, and failure to build a promised temple at that time was disheartening for both the Mexican saints and the church leaders. Bishop Coyle's dreams and prophecies began to stir up disfavor among church leaders. And in August 19, the church issued a formal statement called A Warning Voice, and it was given to those who were listening to visions, dreams, prophecies, contrary to the constituted authorities of the church. The members were not to take stock in ventures based on visions or dreams. 2 weeks later, they repeated the warning and said, the first presidency warns the saints against investing in worthless stock, even if promoters allege they are guided by dreams and revelations. Well, these announcements began to create a strange division among lay members and leaders alike. Some church leaders owned stock in the mine, such as President Anthony W. Ivins, Apostle Matthias Cowley, Apostle George Teasdale, and, of course, J. Golden Kimball. Because of the false rumors, in August 1913, Apostle Francis Lyman released Bishop Coyle from his position, even though the ward members voted 100% to retain him. On January 10, 1914, nearly 20 years after the mining activities began, Bishop Coyle awoke to see 2 men standing by his bed. One was taller than the other. Both had white hair and beards. They announced themselves as 2 of the 3 ancient Nephites who were translated to perform a special mission on the earth. They informed him that because of misunderstanding, church opposition would continue until the mine would be shut down for a short period of time. However, he was to remain patient, and in time the mine would be reopened. They also warned him never to write or sign anything pertaining to the mine. For 2 hours, they outlined the future of the mine and this country. The first half hour of their conversation, he was permitted to relate to the others, but the last hour and a half, he was to keep secret. He never did relate the information he received during that portion of the visitation. Later that year, the church leaders threatened John with excommunication if he did not stop work at the mine. Accordingly, as the two Nephite messengers had predicted, the mine was closed for 6 years. The rift between the church and the mine continued to grow. Then in 1942, when Mark E. Peterson was made an apostle, Bishop Coyle says, "That man will be the worst enemy this mine will ever have." As editor, incidentally, the neighbor of Mark E. Peterson was the one who came and told Bishop Coyle, he said, "We're going to have friends among the general authorities of the church because my neighbor, Mark E. Peterson, has just been made an apostle." And that's when Bishop Coyle told him that he would become an enemy, not a friend. Elder Peterson began a series of articles as editor of the Deseret News against the mine. Under his direction, a hearing for John Coyle was held in 1947, where he was presented with a prepared statement to sign or else be excommunicated from the church. The bishop was in poor health at the time, and under duress, he signed it, and then said it was the worst thing he ever did in his life. However, a year later, 1948, by instruction from Elder Peterson, Bishop Coyle was called to a trial, and then he was cut off the church anyway. Another year later, in 1949, when John Coyle heard that they were tearing down the Second Ward Chapel, where he had last been a member, he predicted that he, too, would soon pass away, and his death occurred May 17th. Of 1949. Then came a strange twist of fate. Before Coyle's death, the mine stockholders were suspects, insubordinate to the church and its leaders, and some, like the bishop, had been excommunicated. However, after his death, a new board of directors became active members of the church and held such position as mission president, high councilman, stake, and ward officers. A new policy was enforced that the excommunicated members could not purchase any more stock. Today, new stockholders have to be good members of the church in order to purchase stock. Notwithstanding the long controversy that still exists regarding people and activities of the Dream Mine, Bishop Coyle's prophecy still stands that at the appropriate time its treasures would be found. But he predicted before this happened, mining would stop in the mine and become very dark. I heard him relate that dream to one of the board of directors, and he said how the whole appearance of the mine would become dead. And it would appear as the whole sky was dark over the mine. And he says, then after a while, a little patch of blue would come, and it would break, and it would open, and then the whole thing would come out. And then shortly after that, the bishop died, and that member of the board of directors, I guess, lost all his testimony and sold all his stock. Let's see. Then, according to Bishop, when the time came, there would only be a round or two to set off the body of ore, because all the preliminary work had been done. The first shipment of ore would not cause much of a stir, but the news of the second shipment would cause a traffic jam of the big cars and the little cars at the mountain. People would come with money in hand to buy the stock, but it would be too late, and none would be available. Now, I want to relate a few of the prophecies of Bishop Coyle and their fulfillment. I'm probably acquainted with over 50 prophecies that Bishop Coyle had made, and I just want to go through maybe 10 of them here if I have time. So, one is World War I. 10 years before it happened, Bishop Coyle foretold of World War I. He also said the 145th Field Artillery, which was a Utah company, which was composed mostly of Mormon boys, he said, would not see combat. And many parents felt comforted by his prediction, but when the newspapers carried headlines of the 145th in action, Fred Squires went to Bishop showing him the paper. The bishop looked at it and says, "It's a lie." And he told him that by the time the 145th would reach the front lines, the war would be over. Well, Fred was holding a paper with the date of November 11th, 1918 on it. And by the time Fred arrived back in Salt Lake City, the armistice had been announced. The 145th did not see combat. Number two, money and men at the mine. He was told by one of the Nephites that both men and money would always be provided at the mine whenever it was needed. And from 1914 to the day the bishop died in 1949, week after week, month after month, and year after year, men and money were amazingly available. Regardless of the wars, depressions, inflations, and persecutions, the mine was always able to meet its operational needs. 3. The water ditch. John Coyle instructed the miners to dig a small ditch alongside the rail track in one of the main tunnels. I talked to the man who told me this story. And he said it was a nuisance to build that little ditch. Bishop told him to make it about 6 inches deep and 12 inches wide. And he said because they were going to need it for water. And then he said it was to take care of the water they would hit at 2,200 feet inside the mine. He even told them the day that he would strike the water. And this fellow that I talked to said that the day that he drilled that hole, he was cleaning out the diggings. They used to single jack, take a big sledgehammer and hit the drill. And this is the way they drilled. And they were never to use any modern machinery until they came through that 3-foot capstone that we're telling about that went into the 9 rooms where the Nephites had found their gold. Anyway, he said that the day that they went up there to work, Bishop said they would hit the water. And he said he was drilling in there, and it was as dry as a bone. And he got about 18 inches into the hole, and he noticed a little moisture in the drillings. And he said when they blasted out the next day, water was coming in, and it filled that ditch up, and to this day, it still fills just that ditch. And he predicted a lot of the landmarks. In fact, one of them was that the day will come when you reach a point there where you see the United States. And they didn't know what he was talking about. And I think it's about 1,500 feet inside the main tunnel there. As you go along, the walls are a little lighter than this. They're kind of a yellowish. And then on that wall, you can see a perfect outline of the United States. It's like a map in dark rock. Very unusual. But he spotted it and told when it would come and everything. Okay, the powder mill. This is a quotation by Sam W. Taylor. Quote, one of his more outlandish predictions came years ago when pointing across the sagebrush desert to a desolate spot, he said there'll be a big manufacturing plant right there someday. The place was isolated. It was on rocky ground. It was above irrigation level. It was far from human habitation. Two, the valley had hundreds of better sites. Came the war, and today a powder mill stands on the spot. Isolation is a prime requisite for a powder mill, and location is ideal. If you're driving from Springville going south to Price, as you look alongside the road, just as you start to go in the canyon, over on the side, you see that powder mill that Bishop told was going to be there. 5, the church reopens the mine. The two Nephites told Bishop Coyle the mine would soon be shut down, but the same powers that closed it would reopen it. 6 months later, the bishop and his worker were threatened with excommunication if they continued to labor, so they shut it down, and it was closed for 6 years. Then Heber J. Grant saw an unpaid bill at ZCMI for over $2,000 incurred by the mine and its operators, learning that by reopening it, the mine would clear up the bill, and so he ordered it reopened. The bishop said that he wouldn't reopen it unless he had a signed letter from Heber J. Grant, and so Heber J. Grant wrote him the letter and told him. The 1929 Depression. In 1929, Bishop told Henry Gardner, his stake president and owner of the bank in Spanish Fork, that 4 months from that date there would be a terrible financial crash in the nation. When 4 months went by, President Gardner called the bishop and said his dream about the Depression hadn't come to pass. Everything was going normal. The bishop reminded him that there was still one more day left. And Gardner says, no, I even wrote down a piece of paper and put it in a safe deposit box in the bank. And Bishop said, well, let's go look at it. So they went in the bank, and he opened up the deposit box, and the next day went. Muddy water. This is one that I didn't believe myself. Norman Pierce, in his book, In the Dream Mine Story, mentioned a prophecy that he heard from the bishop. I never heard it, and I never heard anybody else tell it. But Norm said he heard it, and he wrote it down. He published in the book, I think it was 1958. And it was about He said there's going to be muddy water flow down the streets like rivers in almost every community from one end of the state to the other. And when it comes, it's going to cause a lot of trouble. Well, it was 25 years later, in 1983, that we had all the muddy water running down in all the streets. We're very familiar with that, I'm sure. In fact, I think there's 29 counties ask for federal aid out of 35 counties. Agricultural ruin was $57 million loss, $63 million in road damages, and then the total cost of all the damages of that flood was $200 million. The end of World War II. Shortly after Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941, Dr. Brooksby of Fredonia, Arizona, invited Bishop Coyle to his home for a few days. One morning, the bishop came out of it, I talked to Brooksby about this, and he told me the dream. And he said that they were talking about the night before. The war just started. And he said, he asked the bishop, he says, when do you think the war is going to be over? And the bishop said, I don't have any idea. And so the next morning, Bishop walked out of the bedroom, came over and sat down at the breakfast table and says, well, I know when the war is going to be over. And Brooksby said, when? And he said, it'll be 3 years from now. And so 3 years from then was August 1945. This was even mentioned in a sports column in Deseret News and when it happened. That was okay, and then we're in Kennecott and Geneva. The bishop told many of us of mine that someday Kennecott mine would shut down, Geneva Steel would shut down at the same time, and the tinning mining area would come to almost a standstill. In 1985, the Kennecott shut down, then Geneva shut down, and I thought, well, I wonder if this is the time. I thought it might be later on. So I had a friend working out in the Tinic mining area, and I asked him what was going on out there, and he said, oh, there's hardly anything going. It's just a sunshine mine, and they're not doing much at all. So that one was fulfilled. Then number 10 here is Joseph Fielding Smith's conference sermon. One day, J. Golden Kimball received word that Bishop Coyle wanted to see him as soon as possible, so he drove down to the mine. Coyle immediately got into the subject that was causing considerable distress. He said, Golden, the Lord showed me in a dream that Joseph Fielding Smith is preparing a conference sermon against the dream mine, and the Lord doesn't want him to deliver it. I want you to go up there and tell him not to give that sermon. And J. Golden Kimball says, not me. I'm not going to put my head in a lion's mouth. And Coyle grabbed him by the collar, and he says, Golden, God hates a coward. And so he said, Golden says, all right, Bishop, I'll tell him, but I don't have any faith to do any good. Bishop smiled and says, well, don't worry, I'll take care of the faith. Well, Kimball returned to Salt Lake and went directly to Joseph Fielding Smith's office, and Smith was at his desk. So Golden walked over and said, Brother Smith, you're not supposed to deliver that conference sermon against the dream mine. And Joseph Fielding jumped up and shouted, how'd you find out about that sermon? I haven't told anyone. Golden replied, well, the Lord knows, and he told Bishop Coyle about it. When conference came, Joseph Fielding Smith delivered a sermon, but he made no mention of the dream mine. Well, the greatest of John Coyle's prophecies yet to be fulfilled is regarded as the coming of the mine. The question is often asked, when will it be? I was sitting in a barber shop one day, and the barber was talking to the customer that he was working on, and somehow the subject of dream mine came up, and this fellow asked him, he says, well, do you think the mine will come in? And the barber says, well, I don't know. There must be a lot of gold up there. They haven't got any out yet. Anyway, when will it be, according to Bishop Coyle, to be when this nation is in great peril? He said there will be 3-inch headlines in the newspapers reporting a great disaster. In the same paper, all notice that the dream mine has made its first shipment of ore. I always run short. I got a few slides here I want to show, and then we'll take up some. First, the location of it. You can see Salt Lake City, down to Provo, and the Spanish Fork, and then the Salem area, and go east of Salem, the Loafer Mountains, it's called. And if you're driving down the freeway, and you look over towards the mountain there, you'll see these mountains, and you'll see this mill, And right over in here is where they drill directly in. There's also some shafts coming in from the top. You can see the road bed, the roadway going up and across and over the hump. And they did some drilling up. And it's a very beautiful and peaceful spot. Everybody up there enjoyed it. Bishop said no one would ever come up there. They didn't either. If they had any bad habits, smoking or drinking or swearing or whatever, they'd either leave the hill or they would change. And I watched that happen many times. I worked there for 2 years. Every morning before we went to work, the bishop called us down and we met in a little room there. We got in a circle, kneeled down, and had prayer before we went to work. That's the kind of atmosphere it was. This is the mill. This is Bishop was directed by dreams and how to build this mill. And he built it step by step and built it down. It was quite an architectural masterpiece. This is Bishop Coyle. You can see he's not a pretentious man or proud or vain. He almost always wore these old overall type shirts and very common. Just a farmer. He talked to an old farmer brogue. Very, very simple man. This is a home that he lived in. In fact, the stockholders built the house for him. I used to go down there in the evenings and we'd sit on the porch here and visit and talk. And I used to read him Discourses of Brigham Young and things like that. He really enjoyed that. This is the stock market crash that he predicted 4 months before it happened. And this is the story of the prophecy about the waters and the streets. This is State Street. And I guess this is Salt Lake City. It was Farmington. I have a bunch of pictures that show the whole area. This is, Morphlet. This is kind of a strange thing. The church made this. They were organizing a mine, but this came just 2 years. This was announced in 52. And this came 2 years after they made this other announcement. All right, next slide. So the next one. No, yeah, next up. You're low. Anyway, this is the prophecy on the end of the war. This is the editorial in 46 the church had made. Against dream mines. No one should buy any stock in anything even they had a revelation to. Well, the other trial came about 4 years later where they went into it themselves. Here's the Great Depression. This, I didn't have room. I worked late last night putting this together. But anyway, this is in the Arizona Republic and it shows from 15, let's see. This is about a 6 year span. It ends right here in, the beginning of 88, the end of 87. But you can see the black line here is the crash of 29, and this is the present scale at the same time, almost identical. So the big event, we'll know, if we go into a depression, the mine better come out. Okay, thank you very much.
Please turn the tape over now.
How many of you do you think are related to someone who owns stock in the Dream Mine? Interesting. I found in preparing for this comment on Ogden's paper that it seemed like everyone I mentioned it to was either related to or was themselves a part of this dream. And that is a really interesting thing. Remember that total that he quotes, 50,000 people were involved in this enterprise. So this is not just a small eccentric story. It is a wild story, I think. It has all of the classic elements of Mormon history, which is oftentimes wild. It has a combination of mystical and worldly elements of faith and hard work, of a prophetic mixture of dreams and good luck. I have to tell you, I am probably the very worst person to be giving the comment on this paper. I grew up in a home with a mother who had a very rich and full dream life. She regularly dreamed elaborate and interesting dreams, which she faithfully recorded in a little notebook next to her bed. And then she would talk about them with what I called her dream friends. And as a teenager, would get perverse pleasure out of totally discounting everything that she dreamed and everything that she predicted. Everything she would say to me, I would say, no, I don't buy that. And so going into this, I'm probably the very worst thing person. I am a person who grew up refusing to understand and to appreciate the meaning and interpretation of dreams. And the fact that a man having the priesthood dreams these dreams does not make much of a difference to me, I'm afraid. As a historian, and particularly as a teacher of historical research, I would like to hold Ogden to task on a few technical elements of this paper. Because of his presence at this symposium and last year's and the year before and at Mormon History Association in June, I think that he's thrown himself into a new arena. And because of that, I think that his work needs to start being measured by professional standards. One of my students back here knows what I'm talking about. I would like to give his paper the same once-over I would to one of my students. I really like Ogden, and I expect him to reach and to stretch to meet these standards. First of all, I bemoan the almost total lack of footnotes in this paper. There are footnotes on the direct quotes, but there's this huge number of really sort of outlandish or at least extraordinary claims that are made without any sort of citation. The reader is unable then to place any sort of judgment on those claims. I, for one, believe that you cannot over footnote. We must know where the information comes from. For example, when did John Coyle get his second anointing? In what context did that occur in? Who was the person who was involved in that? Is that secondhand information? Is it firsthand? I want to know all of these sorts of things. The statistics about the 50,000 people who are involved, where does that number come from? You know, is it full, a number that keeps growing with every telling of the story? Or how can we pinpoint that information? Are those kinds of numbers, those statistics, are they just rough estimates? Are they data that Coyle himself or his people tried to keep and tried to accumulate over the years? Are the tellers or the keepers of those statistics reliable witnesses to those facts? I think that information is important to be able to pinpoint. Second of all, I bemoan this paper's almost total lack of interpretive base. I found it in first reading it that I again and again questioned why this had happened. You know, this is a wild story. This is really significant, and it tells us a lot about all of us who are members of the Mormon Church or who are no longer members of the Mormon Church. It tells something about our society, and I want to know what Ogden thinks about what it tells us. You know, not just the interesting little anecdotes, but what does it mean? How does it all fit together? How does it fit into the time frame that it occurred in? What are some of the recurring themes in these dreams, for example? What does it all mean? And third, I bemoan this paper's apparent bias, and I know, we all know that everyone has their own particular frame of reference, their own point of view, and it's almost virtually impossible to write without bias. But it is the most important commission that a historian has to try and eliminate bias from their writing. It's something we all have to wrestle with and struggle to the very last moment with. We need to try to eliminate bias, and the best way to do that in writing history is through a balanced presentation of source materials. Well, what Ogden has done in this paper is present us only one side of the story. You know, we know John Coyle's side of the story. We know Ogden's side of the story. And as a friend, and Ogden obviously believed in the man. He believed in him enough to go and work in the mine, investing not only money and time, but his faith in the man. And that's important. And that bias shows. And I think that this story needs to have a little bit of balance. We need to know both sides of the story alongside one another. I have a real problem with this list of 10 prophecies that were fulfilled. It reminds me just a little bit of those Gene Dixon prophecies that appear on the front of tabloid magazines every January. I don't buy those magazines, but I stand in the line at the grocery store, and I have read some of them. And I can remember one January that it said that Dolly Parton and Sylvester Stallone were going to be married, and that Barbara Bush was going to bear a child, well, First Lady, and that the Iron Curtain would fall. Now, out of those three predictions, one of them is sort of coming to pass, and that's not a bad average. And I, for one, would like to know what John Coyle's average was. How many of the prophecies did he come forward with that never happened? How many of them are we still waiting for? Did he simply speak in a prophetic mode? Was he a predictor? You know, is this the way he communicated? And did he find that people listened more carefully to him if he couched his language in these prophetic metaphors? And again, maybe it's just that ornery teenager in me saying, no, I don't buy that. But I want to know a little bit more about this prophetic process that he was involved in, which is really so crucial to this entire story. Some of the things he prophesied, I mean, I could have prophesied the Depression in 1921. In Utah, the Depression starts in 1921, not 1929. We already have 48% unemployment in 1928. I mean, anyone could have predicted the Depression at that point, I think. How many of them were that kind of situations? Ooh, I sound so ornery, but... I want to be a believer, but I think that again, if we knew more about the total picture, that would be interesting. I think this paper presents some really interesting issues that we might talk about at this point. First of all, it seems to me that the most central issue in the church's objection to John Coyle was that he was receiving revelation separate and apart from the organized church itself. He was making alternate claim to direct revelation from God, from angels, and from other supernatural visitors outside the parameters of the church leadership. And that is really interesting. I can see why they objected to that. But I think that the one question this paper fails to answer is, why was he receiving that revelation? Why John Coyle? Why at that moment in time? Why was it necessary for him to receive it outside of the official church parameters? I think that the implication that this paper makes, and Ogden has written a really interesting longer study of the relief line, is a subtle implication that he does not make directly, that somehow the church leadership had muddied itself so that it was not the proper vessel to receive these revelations. And this seems to be the same sort of claim that the fundamentalists are making about why they are continuing to perform plural marriages during the same time period. It is as if the church leadership itself has somehow failed to perform, that it is no longer the only conduit for the Word of God. And that's really interesting. Do you remember the photograph that he showed of the Deseret News editorial? I'd like to read you just an excerpt from that. And this is 1946, and it's very typical of the kind of language of the church reactions to what's going on in the mind. All faithful members are entitled to the inspiration of the Holy Spirit for themselves, their families, and for those over whom they are appointed and ordained to preside. But anything at discord with that which comes from God through the head of the church is not to be received as authoritative or reliable. In secular as well as spiritual affairs, saints may receive divine guidance and revelation affecting themselves, but this does not convey authority to direct others and is not to be accepted when contrary to church covenants, doctrine, or discipline, or to known facts, demonstrated truths, or good common sense. And then it goes on to say that no person has the right to induce his fellow members in the church to engage in speculations or take stock in ventures of any kind on the specious claim of divine revelation, vision, dream, or undue exercise of authority. That is an interesting thing. Secondly, I think that there was an interesting parallel between the interest and investment in the mind and times of crisis or tension in national affairs. In times of the Depression, for example, more people invested in the mine, even though they had less money, or were more interested in the mine or the potential results of finding gold in the mine during the times of crisis, the times of anxiety, seemed to increase the interest in the mine. I think that the search for gold is a really curious part of Mormonism. There's always been a fascination with gold in the history of our church, and Joseph Smith started us off on this line. His treasure seeking is certainly in line with this kind of dream, prophetic, leading to treasures beneath the earth. Also, I think that the difficulty in ever finding the gold also has historical precedent. Remember one of the stories about Joseph Smith's treasure seeking, when he described the treasure as slippery treasure, and that he said it was slippery treasure because every time the Lord was displeased with the seekers, the treasure would then be moved. And I just had a chuckle in reading this story to think of this gold that's underneath the earth, and it's just sort of moving around because of the lack of purity in the seekers. I think that's a really interesting part of the story. I think that finally, and this is one of the more intriguing parts of the story, I think, the combination of prophecy, business, spiritual faith, and temporal investment is uncomfortably prophetic of the way modern-day Mormons, and I'm sure if I asked for you to raise your hands on this issue, that a lot of you would also have invested in bogus investment schemes in the past decade. It sounds so much like Grant Affleck or Paul Dunn or Gary Sheet. Why is it that Mormons are so gullible to throw in their treasures with anyone who has the appearance of having the Lord's official sanction? Finally, it is unclear to me in this telling of the story when and how the dream mine became the relief mine. Ogden's book, which is called The Relief Mine, and is about the same story, certainly adds more detail, but the series of dreams still do not clarify for me when the search for gold to help for gold's sake, became the search for gold to help relieve the lives of the poor. It appears that none of the actual dreams themselves directed Cole to the dream mine so that he could help the poor, but that he could find unpredestined gold, if you will. Why were so many people then compelled to invest in the mine? I find it absolutely impossible to believe that, you know, however many thousand people invested in the mine would have done that, believing that their mine would then be transferred to the pockets of the poor. You know, they were investing the money in the gold mine or the dream mine to make money. They were. It was really interesting in reading this. One of the excerpts he uses in this is a story about my grandfather, who was not a religious man. If he went down there to invest money in the dream mine, he wanted money. He didn't want to help the poor. He was poor. He was motivated by something entirely different. So that's an interesting question. What was the draw? I think it was the lure, the promise of a profitable investment. And perhaps therein lies the answer of why no gold has ever been found, that perhaps this, again, is a slippery treasure that has been moved around again and again by a God who's not willing to profit an unfit generation.
Thank you both. That's a fascinating story that's not done yet. Are there some questions? Yes, and I will repeat your question for the tape.
I have a question regarding the mine. Not from the area. My father-in-law is from Spanish Fork and recalls very vividly a lot of the old John Coyle and him as he was a boy. Can you relate some of the things about the? He was explaining to me some of the regarding the UFOs or something up there where people used to drive up by the hundreds up to this place and wait for this to happen, and what the background of that was.
Mr. Kraut, do you know anything about UFO sightings connected with the mine? He does.
There was a fellow came by years ago about 15 years ago, that claimed that he could call down flying saucers. And to prove it, there was a big public announcement in the paper that he was going to call down some flying saucers, and he was going to do it down by the dream mine. And so they went down there that night, and a huge crowd. And just by some strange circumstance, there happened to be some meteorites that flew around there, and everybody started screaming and yelling and a lot of excitement. But there was no UFOs called down. It had nothing to do with the dream mine. They just went down there. The fellow believed in the mine, but it had nothing to do with Bishop Coyle.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
I believe this is not the only mine that's supposed to be up in the mountains. There's another one called the Lost Roads Mine, which is supposed to exist up somewhere in these windows. And I wondered if you had any information if there was any connection between these two.
Mr. Kraut, do you know anything about the Rhodes Mine in the Uintas?
No, I know very little about the Rhodes mine, but I think this pertains probably closer to the Lost Josephine mine, because the directions, everything with the Lost Josephine mine was supposed to have been around the Ute Indians, and that was up in this area somewhere, so then they've never found that mine. Now, there was an entrance to the Dream Mine on the south side, and the tunnel going into the mountain there is, one fellow rode his horse in there. You can imagine how high it is. Apparently, the Nephites build their tunnels so extremely much higher than the way that we build them today.
Yes.
Is the Dream Mine still being mined, and if so, how actively?
Is the Dream Mine still being mined, and if so, how actively?
They've closed the tunnel. You can't go in there. I think it was the OSHA that came and said that the ventilation system was not adequate, nor they had to have a lot of other medical team, and I don't know what all the rules and regulations were. So they put a big lock on the and a gate on the tunnel going in, and they very seldom go in there for anything. The mine is, they keep up some of the assessment work on it, and a lot of it is done now on the outside. They do farming. They've got peaches and grapes and vegetables, things like that they do on the outside more or less, just to keep up assessment work.
Yes.
Did they ever find anything of value in the mine?
They found, in fact, I found a nugget up there. I used to carry it in my wallet. People say, well, did they ever take any money out there? And I said, well, I did. But I know one fellow that had a tooth that was filled with gold from the mine. But the whole thing is that that mine is not to come out until this Great Depression that is supposed to come. Bishop said that when that depression comes, it'll make the one in 29 look like a Boy Scout picnic.
What advantage will stockholders of the mine have over people that aren't stockholders when it does come through?
What advantage will the stockholders have over non-stockholders when the mine comes?
The bishop told us that it would be, you'd have a better position than anyone else in the country. You may be able to live united order. That's one of the purposes of the mine, and you'd be able to work at the mine if you needed work. Your family would be provided with work. There were many advantages, he said, that would happen because of it. You know, an interesting thing is Jesse Knight. You're probably familiar with him. He started a dream mine almost the same time Bishop Coyle did. And in fact, the way I understand the story is that he got his first shipment of ore. He located this mine over in the Tinning mining area by a dream that he had. And when he got his first check, he was walking down the street and met Wilford Woodruff. And Woodruff says, I don't know what we're going to do. The church is in terrible position financially. And he said, well, how much do you need? And he said, well, we need just about $10,000. And Jesse pulled out his first check, and it was $11,000 and something. And Jesse went on to practically rebuild or set up the whole Brigham Young University. He gave money to missionaries to go on missions. He gave money to many church projects. So here's a good example of a dream mine that did come true and did come out. And so if one happened, I don't see why a second one can't.
Yes.
I noticed you taking a few notes as Marty was talking, and I enjoyed her comments. Would you mind defending some of the things that she said for a few minutes?
Okay. A few defenses on the criticisms.
Okay, Marty, you're going to get it now. When I found out she was going to go through my paper, I suddenly felt like a new freshman handing over a paper to a professor. One thing is footnotes. Sam Taylor said we've now moved into the area of footnotes, because it used to be they didn't write a lot of footnotes in papers, but they do now. The trouble here is that Bishop Coyle was told never to write anything down or sign any statements pertaining to the mine. And there's the difficult. There's the first source that you want, and you can't have it. If he wrote things down, it would have been so easy. But all we have is secondhand information. Now, the thing is, I worked there for 2 years. I met many of the people. They come down for stockholders meeting every Thursday night, and people would get up and tell their story and what happened to them and how they... Well, that's where you get the whole information that we have is from somebody else. For instance, Heber Hanks worked with me in the mine, and he said, you know, an interesting thing happened one day. My father went down or was working with some sheep, and Bishop Coyle came down and said, I need some help. Could you come up and help me? And he says, my dad was busy with his sheep, and he said, Bishop, he said, I'd like to, but he said, I'm tied down. He said, I'll tell you what, if you go out, if you can find somebody, if you can't find somebody, he said, then come back, then I'll go with you. Bishop said, okay. So he started walking over to the fence, to the gate, to go out. And as he got to the gate, he started to open it up, and he turned around, and he said, are you selling your sheep? And he said, no, I'm going to wait till fall. And Bishop said, well, if I were you, I'd sell them pretty soon, because if you wait for fall, you're only going to get about $3 a head. And he says, and then you'll have to sell them with the bells on. Well, Hanks didn't pay much attention to this, and I guess he forgot it or something. But anyway, fall came, and they had a terrible recession as far as the sheep goes. I don't know whether it was 29 or when, but anyway, he couldn't sell a sheep. He went all over and finally ended up clear up in Bountiful and got a fellow there to buy them. And so they made an agreement, and it was for $3 a head. And the man was buying the sheep. He got ready to sign the contract, and just before he put his name down, he says, oh, and you'll have to leave the bells on them. And then Hanks remembered the whole story that he had had. What is the meaning of the mine? This is something that troubled me for a long time, and I don't know that I have the answer. But a strange thing is that why did this little farmer down here get these revelations and not say come from church headquarters? This went on for years and years and years. This man getting all of these revelations and all this prophecy, and people just astounded because they all have this thing. As he was bishop in his ward, a man got called by the bishop and said, would you come over to dinner this next few days or whatever, bring your wife? And he said, okay. So they went over to the bishop's house, and while they're eating, he said, do you have your food storage program? And the man said, no, I don't. He said, I'm like all the rest of the Mormons. And he said, well, I was shown in a dream that you're to have 2 years' supply on hand. And so the man told me the story. He said, I put up food storage all over in my basement. He said, it was chock full. And he said, you know, I finally told my wife, I said, look at all this food. He said, we must have at least 2 years on hand now. And within a week, he fell off a wagon and injured his back, and he was laid up for 2 years. Well, you can't make a footnote on that, you see. I mean, at least I didn't. And this is one of the regrets that I have. I worked with the bishop. I knew him. I went down. I'd eat with him. I knew him very familiar. And I was too young and dumb. I mean, I just joined the church. And I come down there, and this was the only job I could find. And I went down there and got in with all of these strange things going on. I always thought the bishop would be with us. And of course, he died. But my regret is that I didn't write down the things that he told, all these things that he told and talked about, and every Thursday night, the meetings, the things that went on. It's too bad that we don't make records. Joseph Smith said we should keep records and journals, because the day will come when we look at those things as history and scripture. They're that important. And to me, I wish I would have. I could have perhaps made some footnotes. There are many reasons for the mine, apparently. My assessment of why it happened this way is that this man had... I'm personally acquainted with at least 50 of these prophecies that have happened. Now, if you will stop and think for a minute, how many major prophecies have you heard from the presidency of the church in the past 100 years? Is there a reason for this? I think you probably have to think it out the same way I did. But the wealth, we're told, it's prophesied. Joseph Smith said, the day will come when the saints will be the richest people on the face of the earth. He said, gold will be shoveled up like sand. And, you know, if we're that rich, where's it coming from? We've got to come from mines. And Brigham Young says, when the time comes, the Lord will direct us by visions and dreams where the gold is, and we'll have it then in abundance. And the day will come when he says that a barrel of gold won't buy a barrel of flour. Well, maybe flour will be so scarce, or gold will be so plentiful, or both. I don't know. We're told that a lot of this gold will be taken back to Jackson County to beautify that temple. Suppose a terrible depression, like Bishop Coyle said, would happen now. Suppose it would happen in our time. How many people in the church are prepared for it? And this is what Bishop saw. We're not prepared for it. There's got to be an escape valve. And when those days come, we'll turn to the Lord, and then the Lord will turn and help us out, probably through these mines.